Meredith Kircher, featured in this music video, was just 21 years old when her body was discovered in the house she shared with Amanda Knox in Perugia, Italy. Her father, John Kircher, complains that the world has focused far too much on Amanda. He writes, "Meredith was a beautiful, intelligent, and caring girl whom everyone loved, and her story deserves to be told."
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, victim advocate, analyst, founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-creator and co-producer on CBS's show, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey. And with me today is...
Jim Clementi, retired FBI supervisory special agent and profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and also co-creator and producer on CBS's The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
So today, as you know, we are going to be continuing with the case of Meredith Kircher. And we certainly spent some time reflecting on this case and looking at what our followers on Twitter are saying, and as well as Lisa's been looking at and interacting with everyone on Facebook. And from talking to Jim and Lisa, we feel as a team we really want to do justice to this case for Meredith and her family. And we said at the very start we wanted to do a deep dive into Meredith's life and who she was to find out how she died. And we know that her father wrote a fantastic book, which I've certainly just finished. It's called Meredith, Our Daughter's Murder and the Heartbreaking Quest for the Truth. And this really does colour Meredith and bring her to life, of her character, the people that were in her life. So we want to really bring back the honour to Meredith, bring her to life, the family's experience also of what happened and their plight throughout this case, because obviously there's been lots of twists and turns at court and this has really impacted on the family too. And John Kircher actually ends the book saying, you know, how could it be that she's overlooked in her own murder, and she should have been the centrepiece of everything that happened, given what happened to her. And we at Real Crime Profile absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we started, the very beginning of Real Crime Profile, we started talking about the fact that there were TV shows about real crimes, and they seemed to focus mainly on the bad guy, the people that are accused or convicted or acquitted of crimes, as opposed to the people that were actually killed. And what we know, of course, Laura, in criminal behavioral analysis, is that victimology is critically important in understanding crime. So we want to learn everything we possibly can about the victim. And that's part of why our focus is there. The other part is because they're human beings. And for the most part, they've lost their lives in horrific ways. And they didn't deserve that. And certainly now, what we can do is give them back their stories, talk about their lives, and give them the respect that was due to them that they didn't get in the first place.
Absolutely. And I've always said, if you understand how someone lived, then you understand how they died. And, you know, one of the true centerpieces for us here is obviously the victim's voice, but also really going back to the facts and the evidence and what really went on. And certainly that's where we want to take this, because there's been lots of things that have been coloured in across time and people have very entrenched views about what they think.
Do. Yeah, there are definitely camps in all different places. And we just want to provide a real narrative that's based on fact and also colour in who Meredith was, because from afar it can be very distracting to even get to who she was. And so it's been great these past few weeks since we last recorded to read as much as I could about her, including some of John Kircher's book. I didn't read as much as you did, Laura, but certainly I've gone to many other sources just to understand even just her text messages and just the things that she would do with her friends from, well, we'll get into what her life was in Italy, but it's just great to really understand her as a real person.
Right,
and
to deep dive into it. And it does, you know, take a lot to immerse yourself in so much of this information, certainly that's out there, but to get to the primary sources of the people who knew her best. And as Jim and I know, with any case, that's what you do, of immerse yourself, you know, in the facts and the evidence, but also that you're looking to the people who knew the person best to hold up the mirror as to what they were about. And certainly, you know, one of the key things I'm interested in is honouring someone's life and learning from their death. And this case is a really difficult one.
It is.
To understand. And it really made me empathise with the family. If it's difficult for us to understand, how must it have felt for them being on the outside of it? Not understanding Italian, not understanding the Italian system. And I think that's part of this journey of us trying to uncover the truth and to give them the facts and evidence as we see it. But obviously they were reliant on an interpreter the whole way through, and from their lawyer, Francesca Maresca, who was actually in Florence for most of it, translating what was going on. And that also must have been incredibly difficult for them.
Yeah, and I think it's important, just based on what you were just saying, Laura, and what you said a moment ago, the reason why there are such divergent camps was because of the misinformation that was out there. The media ran with a bunch of salacious, just tabloid crap that in the end turned out to be almost 100% wrong. And because it not only ran with that and just headline after headline after headline, but also just followed up with stories and theories that made, you know, monsters out of people involved in this, I think that misled people into believing one thing or another. And what my hope is that when we go through this, we will help, especially the family, but anybody else who's interested in finding out the truth, understand what actually happened. And then they can understand a little bit more why they were misled and how the ultimate resolution of this case turned out to be the way it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important for the family, because obviously they're the ones that have to live with this forever. And I want them to understand so that they feel better about whether or not justice was done. And if it wasn't, what the real culprits were.
Right. And they feel that they certainly trusted the Italian system to start with. But they still feel there are a number of questions. And I know, Jim, you asked me in the last podcast what those questions were. Actually, we have revisited, and I've certainly read through a lot of what the family have said, and certainly through the book that John Kircher wrote, but trying to get to the absolute heart of what their questions are. And we're going to thread them throughout the podcast, because I think those questions are very real, given everything that took place. So perhaps we start with the timeline, because I think, you know, certainly for me coming to this, trying to understand what the key dates were and the beats of critical decision making is quite important, sort of the overview. So we certainly know that in September 2007, Meredith Kircher goes to Perugia, really excited, as we talked about in our initial podcast, about the opportunity to spend time in Italy, something that she always said that she was going to do. And sadly, she only spent 2 months there. And we're going to talk about her time there. Lisa's read quite a lot about it too. So September 2007, and then she's found brutally murdered November the 2nd, 2007. January 16th, 2009 is the first trial. December the 4th, 2009, which is 323 days since the trial started, Amanda Knox, Raffaele Sollecito and Rudy Gede are found guilty of the murder of Meredith Kircher. And Rudy Gede is sentenced to 30 years, and his trial was fast-tracked at that time, and he appeared in the same court at the same time as Amanda and Raffaele. November 24th, 2010 is the appeal, and this is the appeal on behalf of the defence team where the independent forensic review is requested. October the 3rd, 2011, the report was produced, and it was scathing around the forensics, and they are acquitted. So that's 4 years later.
That's when they were released from prison. When Raffaele and Amanda were released from prison. So they were in prison for 4 years. Well, I think a month short of 4 years.
4 years later, immediately released after spending 4 years in prison. On March 26, 2013, the prosecution then appeal their release. And that appeal goes to the highest court, which is the Court of Cassation, which is in Florence. September the 30th, 2013, that appeal begins in Florence, and Amanda Knox is not present, but Raffaele Sollecito is. January the 13th, 2014, the guilty verdict is upheld after 12 hours of deliberation, but Raffaele Sollecito doesn't wait to hear the guilty verdict, and in fact they're both given longer sentences. Raffaele, 25 years, and Amanda Knox, 28 years and 6 months. On March 25, 2015, almost 1 year later, the final appeal to the Supreme Court, the decision comes back by a panel of judges where they decide that they are innocent and they are immediately discharged of any findings of guilt. However, Gyede still remains in prison. So that's the timeline. It's 7.5 years later that they're found not guilty, and 4 of those years are spent in prison. So that's sort of the broad overview. And now we really want to get into just some of the detail around Meredith and her life, who she was, and certainly adding some colour and some context. So her family, really, mother Arlene and her father John, had 4 children, and Meredith was one of them, so Stephanie, John, Lyle and Meredith, and her parents were no longer together. But Meredith, from everything I've certainly read, and I know, Lisa, you said the same thing, she was known as Mez to her friends, but she was a very bright, bubbly, sunny character, always very positive and very close to her sister, Stephanie. She loved her friends, dancing, clothes, fashion, musicals and shows. I mean, she sounded like a typical sort of London teenager in many respects growing up.
And Laura, so she grew up near Brixton, right?
So Croydon, southeast London. I mean, they were Causdon, which is sort of a very close to Croydon. Mm-hmm. And that's really where she spent most of her childhood. And, you know, her teacher at one of her schools, and I thought it was a very colourful quote about her, said that she was very popular, happy, good-natured, that she never heard her say a bad thing about anybody or anything. She never judged people, and she always tried to see the good side of people, even though she was a very poor timekeeper. And everyone nagged her about her never being on time. And that was something that she was sort of disciplined for throughout school time, and also during her first job working at Gatwick Airport, because Croydon's very close to Gatwick Airport. Okay. So one of the jobs that she did there was sort of directing passengers to their planes. And this is, you know, certainly from a young age at school, she had this sort of passion for Italy, and she went on a number of exchanges. And these are sort of the smaller level of exchanges where you go with the school and you spend, you know, 1 or 2 weeks within another school. And she said from very early on, I know I'm going to live there one day. Which I think is amazing that, you know, she had this very strong sense that Italy was sort of her calling. So when she went to Leeds University and had an opportunity to go to Italy, because she was studying European politics and Italian, as we mentioned before, she was very excited to choose Perugia. And actually, her sister Stephanie, they were incredibly close, and she said that she was very excited for her sister, for her adventure, and that she knew culturally it would be fantastic and meeting new friends, but that she would miss her terribly. And she'd also had a relationship with someone before she left. And I just thought it was interesting reading her father's sort of description of that relationship. Yeah. It certainly, from John's point of view, it sounded, you know, and he obviously spoke to lots of her friends. And he said with the book, he found it quite cathartic, sort of almost piecing together the diary of his daughter's life, the 360 of who she was and everyone that she interacted with. And Chris Ansell was really her first boyfriend. And, you know, it seems that there were a number of parties that they both went to together, but they were both quite shy and they didn't talk to each other. And Chris had an idea of having his own party and inviting her along, making sure that she knew about this party. And that's really where they started talking. But it was really sort of what we would call an old-fashioned courtship. Mm. You know, the first date where they actually went out, they went for a long walk, and they almost joked about it, saying, you know, according to Dad John, you know, it's a very old-fashioned way of sort of dating, going for a walk and talking about things. And it was a real sort of courtship, which sounded rather beautiful, I think.
You know, her father, he was a journalist, right?
And, he was, for the Daily Mirror and also a freelance journalist. And, right. You know, dare I say it, people like Piers Morgan and others, you know, knew him. I mean, he wrote prolifically, so he was very well known in that world.
Yeah.
And I think he inspired Meredith to want to go into journalism and to learn about politics. And of that, he talks about, you know, being very proud. So they talked about worldly issues together too.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly one of the things that she also did, and I did look at this particular video, she appeared in a music video. She was selected.
Yeah, I saw that
too.
Did
you see it on YouTube?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. First of all, I thought the song was great, and I thought it was a really cool thing how they kind of went through the seasons in the song, in the video. But yeah, she was very dramatically beautiful in that video.
It's quite haunting, wasn't it? I found watching it.
Really?
No, and there are some of the last images, you know, when she's coming down the staircase. And I know, you know, John talked about the family watching it a lot, you know, after she was killed.
How recently before she was killed was that made?
I think it was within at least a few years. I think it was
2004.
Yeah.
Some say video. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, people can have a look at that on YouTube. It was Christian Leontiou's song, Some Say. And, you know, she was thrilled to go off to Leeds. She lived on campus, first of all, for the first year, because it's a big campus-based uni. And then she lived off campus with friends and worked at Vodka Revolution, which is sort of a big chain of bars in the UK. And everyone really said what an amazing friend she was. And I think, you know, certainly the family can be very proud of her just from hearing people's, you know, testaments to her saying how bubbly, positive and fun she was to be around and to be with. And this is, you know, in the book we learn about her love of karate as well. You know, she had a third belt and was wanting to get her black belt.
Right, and that's a very important victimology factor, that she would have been physically aware of her body. She probably had some skills. I don't know what third belt means, whether it's like white, yellow, and green, or if it was some other level that she got to, but I know that she did intend to go on to get her black belt.
Right. And you know, you're absolutely right, Jim. Why we pick this out is because of victimology and the things that we think about in terms of, you know, what skills do people have? Would they have been compliant, non-compliant? And actually, John Kircher makes a very strong point that he said she definitely would have fought back, being the person that she was and the skills that she had. I can believe that too, you know, given the training that she had. And going back to him, you know, Lisa's point, him being a freelance journalist, I actually found it, you know, interesting finding out the way that he knew that she had been killed, which must have just been devastating.
Yeah.
He finds out through his contacts in the news outlet world. And, you know, he was told that someone in Italy, in Perugia, had been killed and it was a British person. And he kept asking around, calling up the news desks. And finally, it was confirmed that it was somebody called Meredith.
I mean, I can only relate to this in that I had a friend who was killed in a plane crash, a very well-known plane crash. It was when they showed the list of victims and I saw his name, I just fell apart. I mean, it's such a shock. Like, you know that somebody you care about is in a dangerous place or is in a place where something's happened, and you just can't believe that you actually are connected to it. And so I can only imagine what that must have felt like to have your worst nightmare come true.
And have literally the bottom of your world fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that feeling. He describes it, you know, that he absolutely knew at that point, and then obviously spoke to Arlene and she had had it confirmed too. So I just thought, what a horrific way to find out. I mean, knowing through work contacts, but, you know, they didn't get a knock on the door. It was actually through, you know, people that he knew in his business. And I think, you know, again, it's a double irony. You know, he was told that her name was Meredith. And of course, we use the hashtag, her name was Meredith. So next we're going to talk about Meredith's time in Italy.
The way that Meredith was killed is obviously horrific. We've not really had a chance to properly grieve her because of this whole process has been going on so long. There's obviously been so much attention on the defendants and the case itself, rather than Meredith as the victim. Absolutely, you know, the fact that it's in a foreign country, a lot of it's obviously in a foreign language, we're having to read interpretations of stuff secondhand, And on top of that, the fact that it's been, as you say, sort of knocking on into 7 years now, and the next verdict in this is going to be spring 2015.
So we know that Meredith was only in Italy for 2 months, and you recall the way that, or how she found out about the room in the villa, do you, Lisa?
Yeah, there was a posting on it. She'd been living alone, and she had complained to her mom that she was feeling lonely, and so she wanted to, like lots of people abroad, that you want to dive in and really be, you know, in a house with locals and people. So that's what she did. She answered an ad for a room for rent, and she, you know, she joined this house full of people where right. she had, you know, roommates on her level and then also more housemates down below. So it seemed like a really great opportunity to get to know the town on a different level than just living by yourself.
So this beautiful little villa in the Umbrian Hills, and which we described, I mean, incredibly picturesque in a place that's known for its chocolate and its cobbled streets. And there were 4 girls living on the top floor, and then there were 4 Italian guys living on the bottom floor of the house.
Right, right. And I think it's important to know, you know, Filomena and Laura were the older flatmates, and I think the lease was in Filomena's name, and so she was subletting the rooms to, she had 2 empty rooms to sublet, and she ended up subletting 1 to Meredith, and then shortly thereafter, around the same time, to an American, Amanda Knox.
Right. I think it was at the same time, ironically, that they answered the ad. And certainly, you know, we know that Meredith had a good group of friends, and some of those were British friends. You know, as we know, expats can, you know, start to group together.
Yeah, definitely.
And she had some very good girlfriends, and they would go out with each other. And of course, you know, like you said, Lisa, when you go to a new place, you know, it can be lonely to start with. And, you know, connections and meeting friends and living with people, you know, she was getting to know the people that she was living with. And we said originally that, you know, they weren't all the best of friends to start off with, but you start to get to know each other. And they certainly got to know some of the boys, the guys in the down below as well, and on the first floor. And in fact, Meredith started dating one of them.
Right, yeah. Right. I think what stands out to me, too, is I read some of the testimony and such as, you know, in Italy, lunch is a really big deal. You know, people come home for lunch and they really take their time.
They spend a few hours,
you know, before they go back to work. Yeah.
And then the coffee at the end.
Yeah, yeah. So even though they wouldn't hang out socially, when people are home for lunch, when Filomena and Laura would come home from the law firm and have lunch, you know, and everybody's around and you're talking and you're sharing your day and who you're flirting with and what's happening. You know, it's a very social time, even though you're not necessarily hanging out together socially. And that seems to be reflected in many of the accounts that people have of Meredith, that they would, you know, share things at that time.
Yeah, and the going out scene, you know, them being young, etc. Certainly the Halloween night we talked about a little bit, my first experience of Halloween over here, but it was also, it sounds like, you know, a lot of them went out for Halloween. And yeah, we know that Meredith dressed as a vampire. And there was some interesting sort of anecdote about one of the bars they went to, and the barman was actually dressed as a vampire too. And she and he joked about the fact there was only 1 set of vampire teeth left in the shop. I don't think Meredith got them, but, you know, they had sort of a little joke about that being the 2 vampires at the party. And it seemed that, you know, they had a pretty, she certainly had a good social life and was really keen to learn, you know, was pretty studious in terms of borrowing books from people and spending time on her course and going to the university to learn Italian too, as well as her class on European politics.
Yeah, she participated in all the things that Perugia has to offer. They have apparently a really famous chocolate, I think,
Festival.
Yeah. Right. I think I have had some of that chocolate, actually. And I think there's video of her at that festival and enjoying it. I think she was there with her roommates. And, you know, there just seems like a normal, you know, there's nothing out of the ordinary, it doesn't seem, in any of her interactions with her roommates from what anybody can recall. You know, she's just having a great time enjoying all of the things that the city has to offer.
Right.
And that's something that we will have to get back to later when you hear certain theories from the prosecution and certain headlines from the tabloids. Mm-hmm. But we'll be talking about that in a later podcast.
And text messages, you know, and things that give you a real insight to what's going on, and the relationship dynamics formed a key part of this too, of who was messaging each other. And certainly There were lots of messages back and forth between the girls who, you know, were forming friendships and organising where they were going to meet at what time and helping each other enrol in university. All the fairly normal things, but we know that relationships were being built. Mm-hmm. Equally, you look at where there's an absence of an absence where people aren't messaging each other. So I know certainly, you know, in John Kircher's book, he talks about all the friends and, you know, he went and spoke to all of her friends, both in the UK and certainly in Italy too, trying to get a real sense of what was going on. And certainly, you know, the timeline in terms of what was happening. We had Halloween and, you know, where they're all going out. And it sounds like it was a pretty late night. The next day, everyone pretty hungover.
Yeah, yeah. People are, you know, sleeping it off in their rooms and people are tiptoeing around and, you know, being quiet and, you know, recovering. And I think that that's totally fairly normal behavior.
But some of the roommates had gone away. None of the guys were downstairs, and one of the roommates was out of town. Another one was staying with her boyfriend, and another one, Amanda, was staying with her new boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So it just so happened that Meredith was home alone that evening.
Well, she had actually been out herself, and she had gone to her friend Robin and Amy's, who'd been invited round there for dinner, and they made pizza and they watched the film The Notebook. So again, it just gives you a time mm-hmm. date stamp to that time. So we know that Meredith was captured walking home alone at 9:01, and that was from a CCTV camera. And you said, Jim, that the CCTV cameras, were they running fast or?
Well, they were 10 minutes off based on when the police actually arrived the next day. There's an actual record of the time that they pulled up on the police radio and car, and then there's a record of the video, and they said the video was 10 minutes off.
And of course, you know, the sequence of events is important.
Yes.
So this is where we have it. She's last seen walking to her apartment and initiating a call to her mom, and then the next day she's found dead. And everything that happens in between there has been so highly disputed a number of times. So, and then of course the family has questions that have never really been satisfactorily answered. So Laura, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we will get into the deep dive around the forensics and the behavioral assessment as well, because a case like this should be relatively straightforward mm-hmm. in inverted commas, in that, you know, a crime has been committed, securing the crime scene, running the forensics, and there were lots of forensics and evidence collection in this particular case. But as John Kircher said, and through his own admission in his book, he said the forensics were just so difficult to understand because of the conflicting accounts. And of course, he's trying to understand it, the translation from Italian to English and all different experts saying very different things. Certainly, he does give a nod to all the outpouring of support that he and his family had received throughout the years, and certainly outside court and strangers approaching them and emails and, you know, just how incredible that support was from people. Even the Prime Minister, David Cameron, actually, you know, he says in his book, went on national TV to relay his sympathy to the mm-hmm. family, which I think is quite staggering, you know, in and of itself. And I think at the end, you know, in terms of him saying with what happened at the end of the case, that the family, this is a quote from David Cameron, that the family no longer have an explanation about what happened because the explanation that they had is no more. And of course, there's someone in prison for her murder, but everyone should really think about the family. So even David Cameron gives a nod to the fact that even though there's an ultimate decision at the Supreme Court, that it's still not clear what really went on. And whether it was one person or multiple people. And I think, you know, that's something that we are going to return to.
Yeah.
The family themselves, you know, did start a trust fund in Meredith's name. They wanted to try and get funding to help them with the case in particular, but also to try and support other people who may find themselves in the same, you know, horrific position.
Yeah, it's probably the same position that Natalie Holloway's parents found themselves in when their daughter was killed in Aruba, and Madeleine McCann's parents when their daughter was killed in
Portugal.
There have been so many listeners who are really interested in us covering that, by the way. Just the sidebar, Madeleine McCann, for sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, you may have your country's involvement. Like, I know that the Kircher family did have the British consulate involved, but they were absolutely, you know, devastated financially by the fact that the government wasn't supporting them. And I've certainly heard from other families through my work in the UK as a victim advocate that they haven't had support equally when their loved one has been killed abroad.
Right. And just a shout out to Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, because that the whole premise of that show is about how the FBI can assist in situations in which Americans find themselves in danger or murdered overseas. Mm-hmm. And that actually does exist. The Behavioral Analysis Unit does travel. The Behavioral Analysis Unit did get called into the Natalie Holloway case in Aruba and the Madeleine McCann case in Portugal. However, since they are in a foreign country, a lot of what the FBI can do is based on how much the local authorities will allow them.
It's invitation only, yes. And we had the same situation. And, you know, you're beholden upon them to host you, but to facilitate information exchange as well.
Right. But in this case, in Perugia, seeing as they had not had a murder in 20 years, it's clear that they were not set up forensically or behaviorally or even investigatively to actually do this investigation. In a New York City or Los Angeles, this case would have been resolved rather quickly and succinctly. It would have been documented and investigated and closed very quickly, because this is not a very unusual type of crime. It is clear that there are major failings in the forensic workup and investigative workup on this case, and we'll talk about them later as well.
Yeah, so some of the, going back to the family questions that they have, because John very eloquently highlights them throughout the book. So things like the bloody footprints that we hear about continuously, actually on Twitter and in other places, the alleged blood mix between Amanda Knox and Meredith Kircher.
Yeah, and all that's going to come down to actually what was actually found forensically, as opposed to people's interpretation of what was found, because those are two very different things.
Right, and I think with all these things that they list, so things like luminol being used, you know, to show the mixed profile, was it a staged crime scene or not, And I know we're going to get into that, Jim.
Yeah.
The inconsistencies in all of the accounts from Amanda Knox, Raffaele Sollecito, from Rudy Guede. You know, why didn't Rudy Guede call an ambulance? Why weren't the police called earlier on? This is a question that John Kircher has.
By Amanda and Raffaele?
Yep. John says, you know, when they were immediately in the house, why didn't they call the police earlier? Why did some of these key witnesses come forward a year on from the event? People like the shopkeeper and the homeless man, which we'll get into.
Well, yeah, we really need to talk about that, because you need to talk about McNeeney first before you can get into that.
Absolutely. So the blood on the knife, you know, equally, John Kircher says, you know, that they believe that Meredith Kircher's blood was found on the knife, and that it may be a small sample, but, and it's unique. An individual to everyone. It doesn't matter how big the sample is or how small the sample is. And they,
this is the knife that was found at Raffaele's.
Raffaele Sollecito's.
And that's also, we'll get into that question as well. But it in fact does very much matter how big or small the sample is. It's the science of it actually makes a significant difference, as we've seen in the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Absolutely. And, you know, John Kircher says that there was no contamination, as a different team was sent to search Raffaele Sollecito's house. The other question John Kircher has in particular is around the DNA on the bra clasp. And again, in the book, he says that it was a significant amount and unlikely to have been left by contamination.
Yeah, well, again, he's using terms of art, words I don't know if he knows scientifically what that actually means, but the actual amounts are what's in question and certainly do determine the relevance to a particular crime.
And, you know, this all comes down to what I would call the CSI effect. Mm. I think where, you know, people think that because DNA is found, therefore it's the DNA of the killer. Right. And of course, we're going to talk about transfer, as we have done, yes. Jim C., in many of the cases. And certainly, you know, there was a number, one expert in particular, who said that, you know, cross-contamination is not possible, as DNA is not easy to transfer.
Well,
so we're going to shed some light on that, I think, in the next podcast.
Well, I would like to know who this expert is and actually look at their credentials, because there's an entire branch of science about transfer DNA.
So this is Patricia Stefanoni, who is the lead person for the prosecution's case.
Oh, really? Okay. Surprising. Really?
Oh,
the same person who basically said, oh, yeah, well, even though the machinery that we have, the actual scientific instruments that we have a limit to how much you should turn up the magnification of the noise at the bottom, even though that exists, and this is the first case I ever did it in, by the way, I turned it up all the way. So then I found their DNA in the little noise at the bottom, mixed DNA, multiple male donors for that DNA on that one Brock glass, which would have meant three or four other guys other than Rudy Gede and Rafael Sollecito also were involved in that. It's junk science. It's non-science. It's nonsense.
Well, we need to get into it and unpick it, because it really has led John Kircher and the family's view of what happened and why they still have questions. I mean, he said very clearly, John Kircher did, you know, and I just really want to give him a voice, because these are genuine questions that they
and
have.
And I totally understand it, and I want him to have a better understanding of this. But he will have to, I mean, obviously he wrote the book at a time, an earlier time.
So the final verdict hadn't been returned from
the final
Supreme
verdict,
Court.
Right, had not been returned. And the motivations in that verdict actually explain that evidence that he thought was there was not there. And it did not have any relevance. It was misinterpreted. It was absolutely not scientific.
John Kircher said that the only way that Sollecito's DNA could be on the Brock glass was because he was actually present at the time Meredith was murdered.
Well, I can understand why he might feel that way, but a feeling is not scientific. And it actually, there are many other ways that it could be present there. And we'll discuss that.
And I think she has been forgotten very much so in this case, because it does very much focus on the trial rather than the victim at the moment. However, there are a lot of people out there who still send messages, still donate to the fund, still talk about her. We're very much in touch with Meredith's friends, and as a family we all remember her together. So she's definitely not forgotten, but I think that the focus has been shifted in the case and in the media from actually, as Lyle said, how horrific this crime is, what's actually happened to Mez, the fact she was only 21, and it could happen to someone else just as easily. And I think that's almost the most important part to remember, that actually we need to find out what happened.
I think they're really important things. It's like peeling an onion, isn't it, for us to root it back into the science. And certainly, you know, the family did have their own forensic expert as well. So this is also what they're going from. Another professor, Torricelli, who they had. So he was giving him, he actually gave evidence, but was also talking to the Kirchers. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the fact, you know, and in the book, you know, her being stabbed three times by a small knife of about 8 centimetres, and how she was stabbed with that knife, and the injuries of over 40 injuries, not all stab wounds, some of them bruises, but it led the family and professionals who gave evidence and the court, their judgment to be made that there were multiple killers, and that there's no way one person could have overpowered Meredith Kircher on their own, that she would have fought back, ergo it could only be that there were more than two attackers.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll get into it in detail, but I can cite chapter and verse of not only hundreds, not only thousands, but tens of thousands of cases where that is absolutely not true. And it's unfortunate that there are people out there who claim that is true, and maybe it's because they hadn't had a murder in 20 years in Perugia, and so maybe those particular experts are not as actually experienced But the average homicide detective in the United States in a big city will have, you know, hundreds of murders every year and thousands or tens of thousands over the course of their career. And, of course, in the behavioral analysis unit, we study almost all those cases as a part of our work in the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. So we have quite a bigger pool to draw from in terms of our experience and
behaviorally, investigatively, forensically. And yes. When, you know, I read the statement in the book, and I'll say what it was, Jim C., and you can, we'll get into it. Mm-hmm. But the prosecution and John Kircher felt it was not possible for one person to use a knife to strangle Meredith, to stab her, and to sexually assault her.
Well,
we know that that's not
absurd.
True.
It's completely absurd. And, you know, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to belittle John's beliefs, but the fact is that he can read any of John Douglas's book, Robert Ressler's book, books, Roy Hazelwood's books. They're just filled with cases in which a single actor did many times that. There are cases in which offenders have stabbed their victims, not 10 times.
70 plus times,
yes.
I've seen, you know, on occasion, sadly and tragically.
Yes. And one person controlling a victim. I even recall a case in which the victim was a karate expert, a black belt in karate, and the scene was horrific. It was very bloody. There were many, many wounds, and there was a lot of fighting going on. But in the end, that woman was killed, and she was killed by one person. And in fact, there was also a case in which there were barefoot, bloody footprints that were left at the scene as well. It was one of Roy Hazelwood's cases. And it's just a shame that people who are the victims of crime, especially violent crimes like this, and their families, don't get justice because people irresponsibly make 100% absolute statements like that when they do not have any basis in fact. There are literally hundreds of thousands of cases in which offenders do exactly what they're saying cannot be done.
Of course, and you know, in a family such as theirs, the Kirchers, they've had no real contact with the criminal justice system. You know, when something, tragedy strikes like this, their view and their thought processes are shaped by the people who they are looking to solve the crime. And of course, in this case, in trauma and crisis, they're looking to the Italian police, the lawyers, the experts that they've brought in, and therefore they're being given opinions which sound like it's fact rather than it's an opinion. And I think that's another important distinction which leads them, you know, and John Kircher actually, you know, one of the things I learned through his book, actually had a stroke, you know, throughout the course of all these trials and appeals, which, you know, it weighs very heavily on the family. So actually at the final verdict, he wasn't in court. He was in the UK, and that must have been just horrific for him to be separated from the family whilst they were in court to hear the final verdict. And perhaps it's right that we end it on what Stephanie and Lyle, the family, said, you know, in terms of their reaction to the verdict, which was Stephanie giving the first post-verdict press conference where she said, "We've said all along that we do not want the wrong people put away for a crime that they did not commit, but it's still difficult. We have no answers." And Lyle, her brother, then says, you know, it feels that we've really gone back to square one, that he was perplexed and he couldn't understand how the court could be so sure in the first trial and now the decision that was taken, the guilty verdict, has been overturned. And I think through their lens, you know, we really want to get into the next pod and understand, go through all of the detail of why it is that they still feel that they're left with no answers. And we've started getting into some of it. But I think, you know, certainly the family handled themselves with such dignity and humility in their press conferences. And certainly Stephanie and Lyle, who gave the majority of their of press conferences, I've got to say, I just have huge respect for them, the way that they conducted themselves. And, you know, not through anger or upset.
Yeah,
they were
malice
really,
or anything. Yeah.
No, they were really trying to understand what had gone on.
Yeah, you have to give them credit for that, and I feel bad for the family members, obviously, that had to go through this for 7.5 years as well. I mean, it just, it's outrageous that it would take that long to get any kind of definitive resolution for this case. But I think it all goes back to the foundation, and the foundation is the initial documenting and investigating of a murder. It's very important. It's why it's taken so seriously, and it's why it's one of the most horrific crimes. It is permanent, and the family members that survive always have to worry about that. I mean,
they have a life sentence, and that's what Arlene said at the end, that they have the life sentence that they have to live with. So we're going to end this pod by dedicating it to the family and, the victim's voices and the family. We really wanted to put at the center stage of this pod. But when we come back with our next pod, we want to return to all the questions that they have and start to answer them.
So, yeah, I think there's a number of very intricate types of answers to all these questions.
So please stick with us, guys, as we continue to delve into Meredith Kircher's murder. And certainly the questions that you've given me on Facebook, we'll also be weaving those into the discussion with Jim and Laura.
Signing off on Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.